You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Understanding your immune system and the complex work happening inside you every day will forever change the way you think about your body. This is the epic story of Immune, a journey into the mysterious system that keeps you alive, a new book by Philip Detmer, founder of the popular YouTube channel Kurzgesagt. Filled with illustrations and information you didn't get in science class, Immune is available wherever books and audiobooks are sold.
Welcome back, everybody, to our second talk with Chris Brown. And we're going to talk about his book now, Cosmology, and in more specific terms, the proposal he has in his book. So, just welcome, Chris, back. And it's a real pleasure to have you back again.
Thank you so much, Aleph. I got to say that I'm really impressed with the way you've, how fast you've went through my book and how you've got a firm understanding of it now. Most people haven't given it more than a few minutes thought, and you have really, really put forth a great effort to grasp these ideas. And it's I just congratulate you.
Well, thank you. But it's been a huge joy for me. It's like I've been really inspired to look into all the physics again, and the theories, the equations, and just to check. I wanted to check that I understood the argument. So I needed to put in the numbers and really to get this stuff right. And it's great to read a book that really inspires you to actually do that. So because I think it can't be that simple. And then I put it in, it's like, well, I'm not at the level that I can feel fully that I can confirm things, but I could at least see that, yeah, this adds up. So so I had a great time with this book.
Well, last time I rambled a lot. Last time we talked, I forgot about the audio listeners, and I use my hands. This is a difficult thing to visualize. So, like, it's really helpful to have visual aids. But if you can accomplish it with just audio, then you're doing the Lord's work.
Yeah. Well, sometimes just the audio is really You kind of can focus your mind a little bit more when you just kind of, get into the thoughts properly. Much of this is really kind of a conceptual challenge, I would say, in the book.
Absolutely.
It is this feeling like, okay, you got to step back now and you got to try to build conceptually something in your mind of a different type of cosmology. I've been... like some of the highlights just since last time, just about a week ago, I was just making the calculations on, like the Schwarzschild radius for me, and also trying to look at this, the microwave background radiation. Just, it helps when you get down to the numbers to understand what it's about. That's another thing I discovered again. Like, you can read 10 pages of physics, but like one equation really...
that's
the core of it. You can write 100 pages, but you still can't capture the essence.
The funny thing is there's several different ways of telling the story, but it's, you know, in a mathematical sense, like, I don't want to call it elegant, but it's really simple, you know, and.
Yeah, but it's, I like the different kind of those elements that go into the equations are the standard cosmology kind of parts with mass and density and radius and velocity and light speed. So,
and just to give, I'll just give a brief overview for anyone that doesn't quite this is their first time being exposed. My view is that the universe is not expanding. And the reason I think that is that I can account for the cosmological redshift using gravitational redshift. Now, it's a really simple way to do this. All you have to do is assign a uniform gravitational acceleration to basically all large scale volumes of space. So in other words, you know, you can take a 10 megaparsec, a volume of space with a radius of 10 megaparsecs, just, you know, that would include maybe a few galaxies. You know, it's just imagine a volume, like a sphere in the universe with a few galaxies in it. That the gravitational acceleration for that sphere would be the same as for a sphere that has 1,000 megaparsec radius. So all you have to, like, that is what you're doing there is you are distributing mass in a way that's a little bit different than the way it's visualized in modern cosmology. So in modern cosmology, they think that the universe has an average density and that this is, you know, just one number for the universe, or for the, at least the visible universe. And so, you know, it's, you could also call it the critical density, and the critical density would also depend on, you know, the rate of expansion and lots of other things. But, you know, if you get, into the, like, something like 2 × 10⁻²⁶ kilograms per cubic meter, or something. I don't know. What is that? Like an electron per cubic meter, or maybe a proton? I don't. Something really small amount for the entire observable universe. That's what lambda cosmology or modern cosmology would say the average density of the universe is. And on a large, on a smaller scale, say, you know, just a few few megaparsecs or a few hundred megaparsecs, or even, you know, a couple thousand megaparsecs, on that the smaller scale, it's going to be a different density. Is that something that you would agree with?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those thoughts I warmed up to, especially this cosmology constant thinking, that as you take a larger part of space, then the density goes down. I think that was kind of a stroke of genius, almost, that this is how you solve the problems of a collapsing universe because of gravity. Because
yeah, exactly. If you just,
the bigger radius, the density goes down towards nothing.
Right. Kind of, I mean, if you're talking about, if you want to say a trillion times it to the trillion megaparsecs, you know, just some absurd number. If you just then the density would be extremely low, and so the collapse time, like if you use density in the equations for collapse time, the collapse time for that large scale universe would be like, you know, nearly infinite.
Yeah, but there's a beauty to it. So I think I had the two big light bulb moments. So one was this, when you talk about, or a little bit on the side before that, was I tried to explain to a person this week that there's something like, if you let's say you stand at the sun or like the solar system, and then you want to have the gravity of the solar system, but then you go like twice or three times away from the solar system, then you have to take the mass of this, you have to kind of envision a large ball that goes around the whole of the solar system. And that all the mass in that, and you know the density, that totality of that giant sphere will create a gravity field that is affecting you.
Exactly.
Is that right? Okay, yeah. A part of this talk will be like, I just have to check with you. And then because I said to this person, you have to think then that one little atom that is kind of twice the distance behind the sun is still having an effect on you, because it is still in this kind of hypothetical, let's say, 3 times radius of the solar system, that this giant ball. In the same way that a molecule on the different side of the Earth is also affecting us here, even if it's on the other side of the center of the Earth.
And
is this good?
For me, the best way to do it is just to simplify everything. So you can take, instead of saying you're doing an observation from Earth, you're doing an observation in a place that is real in, let's just imagine a new universe, there's only one star. Uh-huh. And then there's you and your tool that you'll measure the redshift with. Mm-hmm. And you are at whatever distance from that star. The star is surrounded by gas and other dust and things like that, let's say, too. Like the universe just has gas, dust, that star, and you. And so you measure the redshift coming from that. You have to include the distance, because you have to include the amount of dust that is impacting the gravity of that star.
Exactly. But that also means the distance. The distance on the other side of the star, as the same distance as you, would also be a part of the total gravity field.
Yes, right? Because you have to work in a spherical, in order for the Newtonian or for general relativity, you have to draw a boundary, and where you draw the boundary will depend on the amount of gravitational redshift. And currently, you know, physicists, cosmologists just draw the boundary at, say, the star, and then they ignore the other sphere.
Exactly. I think some conceptually here, there's something about not thinking that the gravity pulls you as that, like your mass and two objects, but it is that the star and then the surrounding kind of air, or like the space around with some density, is creating a field that is affecting you. For some people, I think that might be helpful. Because you,
yes, I mean, you know, I'm not going to get in the weeds in that, but you know, I will say that there's a lot to talk about with fields, and you know, with this philosophy of science and using fields and all of that. But you know, it really, that's the bigger issue that I wouldn't mind discussing, is, you know, like the larger scale universe, actually.
Exactly. So, I just wanted to go back to those two light bulb moments first, and then it's coming on the list, like the larger scale, like how we conceptualize that part. So, but just for the fun of it, like it's those moments are nice when, so you talked about this, the Schwarzschild radius, or just like if you look at just the visible cosmos for a while, what we can see, the visible observable universe for us, and you take the total mass of that, we know more or less the density out to 42,000 megaparsec, which is the distance, and then you calculate if that mass was a black hole, what would the event horizon be for that black hole, and then that adds up to be the limits of our observable universe. That would be the distance.
Yeah, you can, the way I did it, because I am terrible at calculus, I have to admit. I mean, I know my way around calculus, geometry, and trigonometry, but only if I have, a YouTube video playing with the guy talking, and a couple articles open, and, you know, doing it step by step. And like, I'm pretty honestly terrible with that sort of thing, but I'm really good with Excel spreadsheets.
Einstein was also kind of bad at math, or he struggled with math and equations.
Like, really, you need somebody to have talks with while you're doing it too. Like, I would need all that stuff and like a professor helping me, and then I could really make advances, I think. But there's just so many areas where I'm like, okay, now what?
but it helped just getting kind of spurring so many ideas, because then you can think it makes first, if you accept this this concept that the light is being affected by a gravity field, like as it is traveling, like that's kind of easy to accept.
Yeah. Like
the longer if it goes 1 billion light years and then if it goes 5 billion light years, it's like it will be affected by more gravity. It's kind of makes sense intuitively, I think. But then to think that this black hole, that it goes back both ways in a sense. So because I was starting to think like this, that the visible cosmos for us is the maximum distance light waves can travel in our part of the total universe. Like it's just like a limitation of the light can't go any further because then it's redshifted out of being visible. So you can't, like it's kind of a natural boundary for the distance for the light, but it goes both ways. So not that we are living inside of a black hole, but if you put, let's say, a quasar next to the Earth, then the light out from the quasar will go then to the limits of our visible universe. And if you're outside of that boundary, then you can't see the quasar anymore because you're too far out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think it may have something to do with just the beauty of relativity and things like black holes. Is that okay? Say you do the Schwarzschild, is what I was saying earlier with the spreadsheet. You can take you can list out all of the black holes, all of the possible black holes, or just, you know, not all of them, but just the range from, you know, the smallest to the largest. Mm-hmm. And we live in the largest, like it matches up. The universe on the observable scale is the largest black hole. Like this is not if you're even talking about the expanding universe. And it's not to say that it's a black hole, but it's when you're talking about stuff like, you know, the visible universe, things like the word object really bothers me anyways.
I mean, yeah.
Because it's all one thing. It's phenomenology is the better way to approach cosmology.
Yeah. Honestly. I think people, like in general, the word object would be connected to matter. So like it's a solid object. That's an object. Like if you take a star and then a shell of like 10 times the radius with space, it's more unusual for people to think of that as an object because it's just like it's a star with space around it.
Right, but it's easy for them to visualize a galaxy as an object.
Yeah, true. So exactly. So if it's, I guess it's like a floating.
That's why I like
threshold. When is it enough mass so you can call it not? You can call a house an object, but it's not a solid object. But
exactly.
Yeah,
it's all conceptualized things from human experience. You know, this is just the way we. I think. This is the way we visualize things. I think Whitehead called it, what did he say? The fallacy of giving primacy to presentational immediacy.
Okay.
It's, you know, this, it's just the way we go about naturally. It's how it's practical. It's a practical way of viewing the universe. But for the cosmological scale, it starts, you can start seeing flaws in it.
Yeah. So I really like that about like just connecting to start thinking about the visible universe, the visible cosmos as a unit that has a density, it has a mass. One of the characteristics of it is like that is as much space as you need to tire out the light so it can't travel. It loses energy. It stretches out too much. So that's kind of wanted to look at this. And then the other big moment, like light bulb moment, was the background radiation. I couldn't follow all of those equations fully yet, but it, at least that you could see maybe some of the same here, that if you take all of the mass and you have this black body radiation, and then the kind of radiation that you might get from something that is the visible cosmos would be this radiation at 2.7 Kelvin. So,
you have to do, the equations are really simple because all you have to do is work backwards from 2.7 Kelvin, you know, 2.7. Yeah. Then you don't have to worry about doing the lambda cubed, which makes it, you know, proper acceleration. That's the part that makes it really hard. Uh-huh. And so, you know, you can just work backwards and just you get a radius of around somewhere around 4,200 megaparsecs, you know, depending on what you use for your density. And so, like, you know, it's just, to me, I'm like, wow, I don't know how relevant that is or how accurate that is, but it's just too good for me.
Yeah. I mean, both of those things could be, still could be like that you're kind of going in a circle, that you're kind of calculating something you knew from before, but it's a little bit striking that both of them, that you could borrow things from other parts of cosmology and astrophysics, and then with that simplicity, it kind of adds up. At least it has to be something to be looked further into, I would say. It's a persuasive. Both of those two things are really persuasive. So I love those two things. And then we've been through redshift. The dark matter could be some of the same. If I understood this correctly, that it depends on how you look at, again, like the object of a galaxy, then, to use the object word in that sense. So if you include the density and more of it, it will add up. Is that right understanding of the argument?
Okay. So the density of a galaxy is going to be very similar to the density next to a galaxy. If even because all you have to do is go out a little bit further than the stuff right next to it. Yeah, there's going to be an area where there's hardly any mass. There's definitely no visible mass. There's no stars, but there's still going to be dust and stuff there. Mm-hmm. It's still going to be much more mass there than the average density of the visible universe. Mm-hmm. So an astrophysicist or a cosmologist, when they look at a galaxy, they say that has X amount of mass. Mm-hmm. They then calculate but according to that mass and that mass distribution, how fast it'll be rotating. What they observe is that galaxies are rotating faster than what the amount of mass in the galaxy.
I found, just for fun, I read through a chapter in an undergraduate physics books here, and it was, they said you had two ways of calculating the rotation, the mass. One is to look at the light, and then you just assume that one unit of light equals one mass of the sun, like one sun unit of light is one mass of the sun in general. But then if you look at the rotation, you get a number that is 5 to 30 times larger. So that's kind of the magnitude of what they're missing.
So
those two methods.
So you can do this with Kepler's. Now, I've only done back of the envelope calculations, but the problem is they assume that next to the galaxy is something like the density of the average density of the universe, something, you know, really small. Like I said, that 2 × 10⁻²⁶ kilograms per cubic meter. Mm-hmm. But it's much higher than that. It's more on the scale of the galaxy. It may be like half of what the galaxy is or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like because there's other galaxies directly beside it. I mean, you're talking, you have a galaxy, then you have the space of about, you know, the radius, the diameter of another galaxy away, you'll have another galaxy. And so, you know, that right there just shows you that the density isn't near zero. It's much closer to what the galaxy is. So if you do that, you get a much higher rotational velocity in your expectations. Now, I don't, whether it would be what did you say, 10 to 30 times higher?
5 to 30. But estimating the mass from just the light is a very sketchy method. So.
Absolutely.
It's assumed that every unit of light from a galaxy is from something that has the same mass as the sun. Like, yeah, they just make up two units, the sunlight unit and then the sun mass, and then they just apply it. it's a very rough estimate.
The thing that's important is not the specific velocity, though, or the amount that's different. The thing that's important is the flat curve. And you can do that by just increasing the mass surrounding the galaxies. Huh. You can produce a flat curve.
It's very interesting how, so you have some of, like some galaxies are just like balls, like elliptic balls with stars everywhere, like an egg shape almost, some of them. But then you have those who just tend to flatten and then start spinning. And that's where you run into this mass problem.
Yeah. And there's probably some other celestial mechanics going on there, you know, but I'm certain it has to do with gravity, and and I'm almost certain, like I would venture to say that it's this problem with boundaries that they're doing, you know, their use of the mainstream use of boundaries. I think that it's because you can't, they're not doing the boundary for, you know, trillions of stars or hundreds of billions of stars in a galaxy. There's just no computer large enough to even, you know, multi-body problems are really complex if you just include just a few bodies.
Yeah. And again, you see it quickly how, in a sense, how little we know and how both cosmology and astrophysics jump to conclusions that has implications that are kind of hard to, it's like for, I think, was it 50 years ago? They got the rotation direction wrong on lots of galaxies. Because you can't actually, see them rotate because they're so slow.
I think it's been since the year 2000 that they were wrong about the Milky Way.
Okay, yeah.
I remember being in seventh grade physics or science class, and the guy, the teacher was just telling us about black holes. Uh-huh. And I asked if there was a black hole in the center of the Milky Way, and he said no. Mm. And I was like, there's not a giant black hole in the middle of the Milky Way that's pulling in all the stars? And he's like, no. Mm. And I'm like, oh, it seems like that they should be. And then, you know, years later, they're like, oh, there's a massive black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Mm.
I've heard this before. It's like kids often ask about this also because it's like, well, so the Earth goes around the sun. And then, like, also, what does the sun go around? Like, well, it goes around the center, the black hole in the center.
Yeah.
There's a fun number. So 110 million years from now, we will be at the opposite side of the Milky Way.
That's a great point. That's really awesome.
So it's a bit,
a bit too long for us to think about.
But yeah, then it will change. We get this parallax thing, lots of things will look different from the opposite side of the Milky Way.
I mean, you almost never look at time as in the rotation of the galaxy. Years are the dominant form of time, measuring time. So,
but it just reminds me that what I also like just reading your book and your proposal is that at least you're really trying to explain things, why it is like this. Because much of the current cosmology, they don't explain. They just make up things that we don't know what is. Instead of saying like, well, we don't understand the mass and the rotation, you get the answer, well, there is dark matter, which causes the rotation. But then there's no way of describing what dark matter is. So it's not satisfying as an explanation.
So, yeah, dark matter is the matter you can't see. It's dust.
Yeah. So
that's exactly what it is. You know, yeah, the planets, you know.
Well, actually, Roger Penrose, I saw him in an interview. It was very interesting because though dark matter, dark energy was brought up, and you can just see his face that he doesn't like this. But he just said he doesn't like the terms because he said it's not dark. It's, if anything, it's invisible or transparent. Transparent matter was kind of his. But I don't think he is supporting these theories.
Go ahead.
So this is what I like reading the book and kind of reading it again now, just preparing for today, just like seeing that at least this is a serious effort to kind of keep looking and trying to find real answers to this. But then that last point of just getting to this, like, what kind of cosmology overall is this then? Because in my head now I have this sense of, well, so this would be an infinite universe, which has a, like, where the density gets smaller and smaller the further out you go, the bigger radius you take, all the way to infinity. And on the side there, like grasping infinity, for me it's helpful to just think about numbers. You have an infinite number of numbers. And maybe that's how you can think about space as well.
You know, I prefer to look at it as an approach to cosmology from a phenomenological standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the idea that the universe is not a noun, or it's not a collection of objects, you know, that the universe is a verb.
Yeah.
And so like every part of it, you know, you're just describing events happening, you know, in the universe. Your experience of those events actually is, you know, that's kind of a more, one of the things on the large scale. So it's helpful to just think about the large scale and how absurd it is to talk about an expanding universe on such a large scale. See, the truth is that I could be wrong about the expanding. It could still be expanding. I could be right about my ideas, and they could be right about expansion. Because, like, there was somebody wrote in a YouTube comment, and it was the first time I'd actually ever realized it, which was kind of embarrassing to say. But they said, you're not saying the universe is not expanding. You're saying the universe is not necessarily expanding. There could be part of it that is, like, he's right. Depending on how you choose the density distribution, then you could have parts of the universe that are expanding. Now, what scale that would be on? Well, on the scale that they're talking about, it doesn't matter, because a galaxy, if you just imagine as it's rotating through the universe and moving across, it's not going to last forever. It'll supernovas, things will, you know, there will be other galaxies strip it. It'll combine.
Now I'm starting to think all sorts of things.
And so if you just follow a galaxy as it's expanding away from you, quote unquote, it really, the space is expanding. So it's, you know, expanding away from, but it's not, like, so just imagine a static universe with all galaxies moving in all different directions. That's really what's going on. They're all moving in all these different directions and colliding and exploding and giving birth. And so really, to talk about, like, 13.7 billion years ago, that's absurd, because that's, our galaxy is only 13.6 billion years old. It's like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
Okay, as soon as the galaxy formed, that's, you know, that was basically the beginning of the universe.
I like, so this was an afterword in Einstein's book from 1916, that we run into a peculiar problem with this expanding universe, that the total age should be something like 10 billion years, was the kind of the early estimate. And he said that's younger than the time needed to create these superstructures on the largest scale in the cosmos. And he said there's no way to reconcile this stuff.
Methuselah, which is a star in our galaxy, it's actually really super close. I think it's like a couple hundred light years away.
Yeah.
It's estimated to be 14.3 billion years old, and the universe is estimated to be 13.7 billion years old.
And that's a close one to us.
We have a star that's older than the universe. That just doesn't make sense, you know? Well, and that's actually a big mystery in cosmology. Like, that's an admitted mystery.
But there's also, I mean, expanding space is not, it's a suggestion, but it's not, it doesn't explain what that means. But, well, there's also
There's no force behind it.
Yeah, but there's also no definition of what space is. So, well, you can think of, okay, again, like a jelly blob and you're just stretching it. But like, yeah, but then in that case, space will have a fabric. Like, is that the suggestion? Back to like the overall picture here. So what I was thinking then, so you have an infinite universe and density goes down. And then what we see, it's like this little flashlight kind of thing. Like, we see this little sphere that it has a radius of 4,200 megaparsec. And that's kind of, in a way, what we're given as a playground, in a sense. That's what we can toil around. We have the Earth, we have the solar system, the galaxy, and then we have this little bubble of light that we can... So if we travel 10 billion light years in some direction, the whole, the visible universe will change for us. And we have no idea what the totality of the cosmos, the universe is. Would that fit with your model here?
Yeah, and that makes much more sense to me. Like, okay, if, say, galaxies are moving away from you,
yeah,
and you get closer to them, they're going to slow down as you get closer.
Mm-hmm.
That's odd. However, to say that there's less gravity affecting the light as you get closer, and so the redshift decreases,
mm-hmm,
then that makes sense.
Yeah,
And then
you get into the speculative part about cosmology and like the creation at large. Like, it seems like I kind of like this intelligent design kind of thinking, that it's so fine tuned that it doesn't seem random. Like, I have no thinking about if it is made by something or someone or that, but just like, it seems hyper sophisticated, the whole thing, is my sense of it. And then what you're proposing fits better. Instead of this kind of this bouncing in and out blob that just kind of explodes out of a light point and then out and then goes back, and maybe a new rebirth, and you have this sequence, something like this infinite universe with this density thing, and then it's just conceptually it makes sense. I'm not sure if intelligent is sophisticated. It's much more advanced kind of cosmos you're then trying to envision, is my sense of this.
Yeah, I think that's the general purpose behind it, because there's a fundamental problem I have with the Big Bang. Like, it's the Big Bang, you know, there's been a lot of people that's come out, and they've been trying to, I guess you could say, correct the record about the P and the, you know, the Big Bang being a singularity, a single point, and then it's more like this thing that happened everywhere. And so, like, it just gets worse and worse as it goes along. It's the reason it sounds weird is because it's not possible. Mm. What they're describing, it's possible using mathematics, but it's not something that we, it's if you was to be able to go back 20 billion years, the universe would look exactly like it does now, and the universe is going to look like this on just about in all universes. Like, that's what's even more interesting, I think.
So do you think it's infinite in time? Do you think it has a start, some sense that we can grasp?
I think that you have a start. I think that consciousness has starts and stops, but it's irrelevant. Things like time scales are only relevant for human conception. You know, it's for practical day-to-day use, but,
uh-huh,
you know, it's like when you talk about God or really just consciousness in general. Consciousness, it should be also considered like the universe, the way I do the universe. We all look at consciousness as a bunch of individual souls,
yeah,
but, you know, like it's better to look at it as a perspective of a phenomenon. Mm. Mm. I don't, and like it, so that in itself is this concept. And that, yeah, is really the most fundamental. Like, you know, the other part, the objects are really just, they arise from that phenomenology.
Mm. Mm. So I'm a little bit kind of cautious here to kind of tip all the way into theology and kind of this a spiritual realm and the material realm and kind of the material as created and. I'm getting all the quotes there, like life is smoke. That's one of the, well, Ecclesiastes has this one. It's all, oh, that's like,
is that a real quote?
Yeah.
He says, that's life, great. Life is, I've never smoke, heard that.
It just manifests into a shape and then it just dissolves again. And that is life. So.
Yeah, that's a great way to explain it. But it's more like, life is smoke, but the word smoke is, you're describing your experience. That's what you mean, your relative experience to the smoke.
Yeah. Mm. But just I just wanted like to get a sense of, let's say this, the before we go into the consciousness part again, but like this more scientific material physics nature of the cosmos. If it's, I'm just thinking, so Roger Penrose again, I really like his work, and he has the cyclical universe theory for 20, 30 years, I think. And he talks about like all the matter would go into black holes, and then the black holes would crash into each other, and then eventually you would just have some giga black holes and they will evaporate, and then you only have radiation, you only have photons in the whole of the cosmos. And since photons and radiation have no sense of time and space, he says that there's some kind of geometry that will show that then actually you kind of, that will be the tipping point where just everything just, it's not even contracting, but it is suddenly being just one single point again. And then it will tip over into being a new Big Bang. So this is one of his theories.
I love this. You know, it's way better than the current ideas.
Yeah.
You had a butt, so I love like.
Yeah, it was what I like. He says that if you look at this cosmic background image, the famous image, he says you can see remnants of the previous universe in that one. Given that that is a picture of the early universe, yeah. So my butt is that, if one could construct the universe, like, would this be an elegant way of this of designing or creating a cosmos? Wouldn't an infinite one be more elegant that you can just, and then things can just go on there forever? Like you have solved it. You don't need this. It's a bit clunky almost to have this kind of death and birth. And it's, I mean, you what you're doing is you're applying a very typical kind of human and animal life cycle
to
the cosmos, which might be right, but it's I like this.
Well, see
why don't you create something more advanced? Yeah,
Penrose's idea is, you know, like it's definitely a step closer to being correct, but it's like you say, it's the entire point of him describing the universe as, you know, this expanding and then collapsing thing with life and death is that he's trying to explain the redshift. You know, that's his entire thing. But you can use his ideas. Okay, so there's this point where the universe collapses, and then there's this point where the universe expands again. Okay, so if you just take the middle part, the part between the collapse and the expansion, and then just put a chain of those together. So in other words, it's not, so you decrease the density a little bit, or you adjust the parameters so that it doesn't fully collapse. It starts expanding again before it collapses fully. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you do this on a giant, 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 giant scale, much larger than the visible universe. And what do you have? It's just a static universe, like, because it's what's going on is it depends on the boundary. The collapse depends on the boundary that you choose. You know, you can choose any boundary because you have the observable universe, and then you have outside of that, you know, like, so you can just choose whatever boundary. But collapse happens, like, if you're using general relativity to model what happens to mass as it's moving around, then you can say that sections of the universe collapse and expand all the time. There's things go supernova, things explode, things run into each other, things, stars pull in dust and turn into black holes strip off all their, or they absorb all their surrounding mass and then start evaporating out. So all of these things are true. Yes, it is expanding and collapsing in certain regions. It just depends on what boundary. The boundary that Penrose is talking about is like the whole universe. Well, that's absurd. Because like you're not like the, you don't know what the whole universe is. But you can talk about, you know, you can a specific region. Sure. And so like he's just off on scale a little bit.
It's starting to wander a bit here in the thoughts, but like it's almost there's sometimes a kind of a need for the human mind to grasp things, and that suddenly imposes constraints on theories. So it's almost like when you then, if you went from having, I had to read up on the static universe, like the steady state universe that was dominant before the Big Bang. Maybe there are lots of good thoughts in there that has just been kind of ridiculed now for many decades, but maybe it's there's something to pick out of it, but that's hard to orient yourself in a sense. And then you make a model that is much more tangible or kind of grippable. So it's a Big Bang. It's a, like this pulsating blob of like a cell, like it's, but then people want to break out of that again. And then suddenly you start talking about multiverses. So you have many universes floating around, and then you're breaking the boundaries again. So it's kind of this back and forth thing going on.
Yeah. And I'm not sure why you need multiverse, because really relativity shows us that it's the observation and that really, you know, there's quantum physics has this probabilistic view, and you know, it's the observation is what causes the wave function collapse, something. And so that's I think this huge hint, especially when you're talking about the quantum scale and the scale of the universe, that you can't use this objectified, quantified, mechanical universe. You just can't use that same type of language for those scales. You have to resort to phenomenology.
So could you just specify a bit what you mean with phenomenology? Like version of it, in a sense?
So, I mean, that's a tricky one. You know, honestly, this is my ideas pretty much in this area all come from Alfred North Whitehead. It's kind of a hard thing to even communicate. It's the idea, that objects are the wrong approach. So like with particle physics, yeah, it's great to talk about an atom, but an atom's not a little ball, you know. And you know, this is definitely undeniable for anyone that knows anything about an atom. But that's the way that it's viewed.
Well, I guess that's what the old Greeks started with, is kind of this minimum unbreakable unit of mass ball. I guess I already started.
It's much better to look at the whole universe as like a wave, and you know, each thing is the shape of the wave at that area, whatever it is. That's just the way the wave is in that part. But and that wave is like, really, it comes from the way, from our observation of it. Like, from there you have to get into theology, but I really don't. I mean, it's a complicated topic.
Yeah, but it just strikes me as well here that there is something about it's almost like a fundamental approach or kind of how you see things, that if you think the world is beyond us or not, like, do you start looking into things expecting our human brains to understand it all, or are you fine with kind of that the model we make would be partly beyond us? Like, I go for the latter. I think my sense is that's more likely to be true, as we understand some of it, and then we can have some of it that we don't, but not like a concept like dark matter, but like it is infinite, and then the whole gravity field creates a stability over the totality of the infinite universe because of the density part. And then you avoid this, you know, huge collapse of the whole thing, which would be kind of a simplistic error if you kind of create a universe.
Yeah, and it also shows you that, you know, where the region would collapse. And, you know, it's like the scale of like stars and galaxies.
Yeah. Yeah, it collapses on the small scale, which might be a part of the design of it.
That's Penrose's cyclical galaxy or cyclical universe. You know, it's just the whole, like, if you just take his model, adjust the scale a little bit, and then just make it an infinite number of times and arrange it everywhere, then that's what's going on. You know, there's just all these collapsing things floating around. And you know, I think that this is, go ahead.
Well, what I really like is that if you can think, so we live and we have our little radius of visibility in our little flashlight part, but then we might move like three flashlights away and discover something totally different. That also makes sense. I just have this, but this is again, now we're into the belief part. But I think it never ends. I think the discovery never, ever ends. We always expand and discover new things. That is a belief. But in some sense, all science would be based on some kind of intuitions of sorts, or just presumptions or beliefs, I think.
Yeah, like science is like the study of like causal relationships, you know, it's physics especially.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily fit for describing reality. Mm. It's, you know, it's a practical way of talking about this reality, but it's not standard in all realities. You know, in your dream, that's definitely a different reality. That's a different universe. You know, you are creating the mass in your dreams, but things certainly have mass, you know, in your dreams. If you're in a car accident, you're going to be thrown around and stuff, you know, but the physics of that is going to mimic this, the physics here, but it's not going to be exactly based on whatever, but it's going to follow whatever rules that are assigned to it from your subconscious, but it's really not that much different than this universe.
But it is helpful sometimes to just, like a version or like some of what you said, that like that it is a tool. Just remember, sometimes science is a tool. Mm-hmm. It's not a totality of explanation of everything and existence. It never was in the past, but it's kind of been there for a while maybe. But it's still, sometimes it's good to step back and just remember it's a tool that is extraordinarily helpful. But it has its limitations.
Absolutely. I mean, the Big Bang Theory really does nothing for anyone as far as philosophy goes. It's an interrupter, you know. It makes you think differently. You're like, wow, what?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really confusing.
At some level, I think it's, if you have in the back of your mind that we're living in this stretched out little blob, or if you think it's an infinite space and we are only kind of fortunate enough like to be in it, and we can see one little sphere of illuminated part of it, and there's an infinite amount beyond it, like it, for me that makes life and existence like immensely more interesting as well. That's not an argument for any theory, but it's just like a reflection I'm having now.
I agree completely.
At some deep level, it affects how you experience existence in itself.
Whitehead, his one of his goals was to ascribe purpose to reality, not just the universe, but reality. Mm. You know, like the universe is obviously just this environment for reality to take place in.
Yeah,
and it seems like it's a hint. The scale of which the universe, the visible universe, the scale we're talking about, and what it is just a bunch of exploding giant balls of fire. I mean, that makes it, it's almost absurd to a point where it's like this giant hint about reality, you know? It's like you, there's a lot more than you. It's this thing that should touch at everyone's ego, you know? There's the mysteries out there are infinite. The mysteries are infinite, certainly. And the way to approach it, I think, is science is useful for sure, but you have to always keep one foot in, I don't know what, but you have to be grounded and open.
Yeah. Well, I mean, since I've been doing so much Dante for 2 years in the Divine Comedy, like the grounding is the main foot should be in a spiritual sense. That's the medieval thinking. And I mean, he loved science. He learned science with the Franciscans and the Dominican orders in Florence. So they had kind of that was what was around the science. But yeah, and that's what's the timeless, and that was the deeper truths of existence. So that was one way of thinking. But this was like the 1200s, 1300s. But in a sense, constructed as that is the timeless, which the immaterial is the timeless, and that's what you have to base your thinking and your feeling and kind of your soul, your spirit. You have to base it in that, and not the material. So,
yeah, absolutely.
But then we're tipping way into theology suddenly. But it's a practical theology in a sense.
Yeah, I think practical theology is definitely the way to approach it. I mean, well, theology itself is, you know, that can mean a million different things. But this, really,
It's the fun, the interesting part of this is like we end up here like every time if you talk long enough, that's where the conversation, like that's the boundary, that's the transition point, that is the transcendent point where you start grappling with questions that just goes, yeah, but what beyond that, and then why is it here, and like what's before it, and what's the beginning, like, and especially the purpose, like this teleology part, and then
especially because
those questions are just giant in front of you.
Scenarios like traditional religions or even just wild theories about this reality, all of those things are like, they're just, it's like scenarios within the bigger picture. Like almost anything you come up with, any story you come up with, it's a potential scenario within the bigger picture. So you could, this life for you, you could be in a spaceship traveling to another star, and you're just in some pod sleeping and experiencing life on Earth as you're traveling to this other star. Well, you know, that would be the scenario for, and that's probably happening. There's, you know, similar things probably happening in this universe.
And those are, they're very popular, but they don't solve anything. Well, was it the brain in a vat thing as well? Like, yeah, but if that's true, what about that world where your brain is in a vat? Where does that come
truth,
from? And what's the beginning of that world? Like, you just postponed all the questions. It doesn't solve anything.
Yeah, the truth of it is that the brain in the vat is just a subset scenario. It's just like a sub-scenario of the overall scenario. Yeah, you can have a brain in the vat. You could be a brain in the vat. But it doesn't really say anything about the big picture of reality. I mean, does. It does because it opens the door to phenomenology. But to me, the ultimate thing is that, you know, like consciousness exists, and it's this concept, it experiences what it experiences depends on the scenario that it's in, but that is what reality is,
and that's
what consciousness
been, that's what's been boxed in by science as just the hard problem, and then you leave it at that. I just wanted to be about an hour now, in terms of like the a little bit back to the more tangible stuff. So It's very tempting to go deeper into the theology part, but just as like to I don't know, like plant some thoughts out there or something. Like, what? Where do we go from here? Like, so you've been thinking about this. You've written the book. What's next? Kind of the next decade. Kind of what's what are the discoveries? Where should we start looking for things? What are kind of now for the material part of this and the visible cosmos? Do you have any thoughts about that? Like, where to does this give us some new areas to start looking into for to find something specific?
I think there's going to be more and more talk of gravitational coherence on larger scales, and so you have a galaxy, all the stars in the galaxy has gravitational coherence, and then you have a cluster of galaxies. They're going to be tugging on one another also, and so they're going to have that gravitational coherence, and you're going to have this on all scales. And I think that that's going to be realized at some point. The whole expanding space paradigm is really confusing for everyone because they think that the Hubble shift is explained, but then they have all these other mysteries that like dark matter, dark energy, and inflation itself. Just the theory of inflation is the theory doesn't even make sense. There's going to be more and more bucking that system, but unfortunately academics have a hold on it and they do not publish anything outside the current paradigm. So maybe philosophy is the maybe this, what we were talking earlier, or just a few minutes ago, the outlandish stuff at this, I mean, it sounds outlandish at this part, the theology part, and the limits of it. But I think that if there was more philosophy of science, I think that would demonstrate it. Yeah. That would help them develop a more coherent model, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely. So back to the 2 years of studying Dante deeply, it has changed my brain. I really feel it. And it's a more comprehensive way of thinking and looking at things, from being more like focused on just the science logic part, thinking about the cosmos. And that was the argument, like specifically in his work as well. I'm not going to promote Dante here, like it's too much, but this is what his whole claim is, that this is the way you can use your whole brain, both of your brain parts, the left and the right hemisphere, to just have enormously more intense and deeper and broader kind of thinking and experience and understanding of also science, but also like everything about the world and yourself. So that was there earlier, and I think it can come back. And if you look at someone like his writing, which is very based still in some sense on rationality, you get the sense that there's something that has been lost, and that might contribute to lots of new big things. So that's my little hope, at least. And it could be fun.
Technology is certainly going to keep advancing. And one of the things is just general understanding of health and, what it takes to actually have a good functioning brain, and also how to learn things quickly. And so like, just, I would just imagine that intelligence is going to advance, I don't know if it's exponential, but definitely at a growing rate. And the also computers gives us this language set, the idea of simulation, the matrix, all of these words that we have to talk about the reality will continue to help us think about reality and describe it in a more accurate way. And I think we'll see a resurgence of this existential way of, this idea that we are able to create our own reality as we gain more control of realities. But I'm not so sure that it's going to lead to some philosophical revolution or anything like that. It's just going to continue to evolve the mainstream perspective. The mainstream, I think, like groupthink and something like, you know, science and philosophy both are things that, you know, you can refer to science as the body of knowledge or the process of searching for the adding to the body of knowledge. You know, there's two different concepts for the word science. And so on a group level, science may or may not be able to accurately describe reality, because group thinking is not necessarily the right way. But individuals are certainly going to have a firmer grips on what this reality is, what it means, and, you know, just an overall understanding of everything.
Hmm. I think you laid out some great topics to have future episodes on. I would really, I think we should do another episode one day and go really into the philosophy of this as well. And I'm thinking, just try to get a little hold of like the topics for today now. And then also, I really like what you said about gravity there. That actually just summed it all up for me. Like, that's underlying all of this, both the overall cosmology that I kind of have a sense of that's being sketched out in some sense in your book, and the main topics with redshift and dark matter and all of them really. And it also ties into, it's a bit Einstein in there. Like, he's also kind of, gravity is the big thing. Stephen Hawking was very much there. Like, gravity is that which sets it all into motion. Gravity is the action that kind of makes it going. And if your book can lead to some deeper understanding of gravity, the nature of gravity, that would be a really, really big thing.
I mean, for me, gravity is the same thing as okay, well, it's, gravity is the universe. Gravity is time. Yeah. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. And gravity is space. Mm-hmm. Gravity is mass. Everything is gravity. Like, that's, if you're describing the physical universe, it's all gravity. Now, that's a little more profound than it sounds. It sounds kind of silly, actually. But if you just look at gravity as this flow of mass, and the universe is this mass. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what the universe is. It's just a bunch of mass and the flow of mass. And so this flow, it flows towards the mass. It's like an inward.
It's interesting flow. If what you're doing now is you kind of changing what people usually think, that gravity comes from mass. But if you think that the other way, that gravity is that which mass comes from instead, that's also a big thought to ponder.
I mean, yeah, it's all the same thing. Like, mass is gravity, or it comes from gravity. Time is gravity, or it comes from gravity. Space is gravity, or it comes from gravity. It's just this wave dance. It's this geometrical wave dance of Cartesian coordinates. And these Cartesian coordinates are really just the human conceptualization of whatever this phenomena is. You know, it's,
yeah. And I think I'm gonna let that be the last word. That was really great. it's hard to go anywhere beyond that. That was a fantastic way of kind of the end note for this part. So I hope this has given a kind of an overall impression of the cosmology and the main parts of the book. So I think we're just going to wrap it here. And just again, thank you so much, Chris. I'm enjoying these talks immensely and I'm learning so much. So thanks for your time doing this.
Thank you too, Aleph. I can't wait to do this again. I would like to say, if anybody wants to learn more, they can subscribe to my YouTube channel.
Yeah, do the plugs.
My name is Chris Brown. The YouTube channel, you could just search "The Universe Is Not Expanding." Maybe you might have to type in Chris Brown, and you should be able to get it to it. My website's theuniverseisnotexpanding.com. Mm-hmm. The book is called Astrophysics for People Who Think Physicists Are Full of Shift. Mm-hmm. And if anybody wants to talk about these things, please send me an email. Like, I love these conversations. And Aleph, you're the perfect person to talk to about this. Like, you have the great...
Thank you.
A great awareness. So, like, I definitely want to continue these discussions. There's all kinds of things I want to talk to you about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we should just do it regularly and then see how it goes. And I will also just recommend your book and your website to anybody listening now. That's how I started. I just searched on YouTube, like gravitational redshift. And then your video popped up and I watched it. I read your website and I sent you an email and you responded very quickly. And it was super nice. So it's...
And if anybody, yeah. if you can't afford the book, like, you just email me. Like, mm-hmm. if you look hard enough, you can find my email. Then you can just send me an email and I'll give it to you. I'll just send you a copy. Like, I don't you know, mm-hmm. the point is the idea. Like, I want to spread the idea. I'm not competent enough to take this to the level that it needs to be taken, I think. And so I'm going to need help with this.
Yeah. And as like, so far for me, it's like, I will highly recommend the book as both what is in there, but it gives you a starting point to start thinking, really. And if you disagree with it, I think that's also great. Then it will be interesting to hear. So, So, just say for this one, thanks everybody out there for listening. Hope you enjoyed some of this and had some inspiring thoughts and some new food for thought. And thanks again to Chris. And as always, thanks so much for listening and see you all again next time.
The General Insurance presents Shower Ballads by Shaq.
And I'm gonna keep on loving you, cause it's the only thing I wanna do.
Turns out, everyone does sound better in the shower. And it turns out, The General is a quality insurance company that's been saving people money for nearly 60 years.
I just wanna keep on
for a great low rate and nearly 60 years of quality coverage, make the right call and go with The General.
The General Auto Insurance Services, Inc. Insurance Agency, Nashville, Tennessee. Some restrictions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.